So imagine waking up, right, on October 15th, and you grab your phone. You open an app to talk to, well, essentially your closest confidant.
Yeah, the entity that knows everything about you.
Exactly. Someone or something that knows your deepest fears, your daily routines, maybe even secrets you haven't told your own family. But when you open the chat, you find out the government has just permanently deleted their brain. The conversation is just gone.
Oh, wow.
And you had absolutely no say in the matter at all.
I mean, it sounds like a pitch for some dystopian science fiction movie, right?
Yeah.
But that is literally happening right now, this very week. Real users are getting notices that their digital companions are just being wiped from existence.
It's wild. And it really highlights the absolute absurdity of this current moment we're in. I mean, we are living through the week of July 7, 2026, and the ground rules for the most powerful technology of our generation are being written right now.
Right under our noses.
Right. But here is the catch. You, the person whose data actually trains these models, the person relying on these tools, you are not in the room. In fact, the people building the tools aren't even in the official rooms where governments are trying to regulate them.
It is a massive global disconnect. I mean, we are watching a real-time tug of war over who actually gets to control your digital life.
And that is exactly our mission for today's deep dive. We have this fascinating stack of fresh dispatches from TechCrunch, AI News, Stat, and the eSafety Commissioner.
A lot of heavy hitters this week.
Yeah, seriously. So we are going to map out exactly where these rules are being written. We'll contrast the highly public government summits with the fiercely private maneuvers of tech billionaires, and ultimately figure out where the everyday user actually fits into this whole puzzle.
That was good.
Okay, let's unpack this by looking at two very different rooms that were convened this week. Let's start with the public one over in Europe.
Right. So this week in Geneva, the United Nations opened its first global dialogue on AI governance. And structurally, I mean, this is as formal as it gets.
Pomp and circumstance. Yeah.
Oh, completely. You have 169 countries gathered there under a direct mandate from the General Assembly. They're attempting to write a unified global rulebook. And the tone in that room is just incredibly grim.
Really? Grim how?
Well, you have the UN Secretary General explicitly warning delegates not to let AI, quote, vibe code humanity's future.
Wait, let's stop right there. Vibe code humanity's future. I mean, it's a catchy phrase, but what does that actually mean in the context of, you know, international law?
Yeah, it gets to the core anxiety of how these large language models are built.
Yeah.
When you train a massive AI, you are feeding it the entire internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is full of biases, awful behavior, and conflicting values.
It's a mess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the engineers then try to align the model using this vague human feedback. They're essentially trying to give it a good vibe so it behaves safely. The UN's warning is that if we leave it up to a handful of engineers in Silicon Valley to decide what a good vibe actually is, they are implicitly hard-coding their own cultural values and blind spots into a technology that the entire planet will use.
Wow. So they are coding the future based on a corporate vibe check.
Precisely.
Which is terrifying when you realize that scientists were also briefing these delegates in Geneva, telling them that current safeguards simply cannot keep pace.
Right. The math just doesn't support it.
Yeah. The fundamental math of neural networks means no one can actually guarantee a machine will follow its guardrails 100% of the time.
Exactly. The scientists were making the case that we are basically building engines without understanding exactly how the combustion works. So Geneva is in a state of high alert. You have 169 countries trying to put an emergency brake on the future.
But the people who actually know how to build the emergency brake aren't even there.
No, they are decidedly not in Geneva.
Right. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, wasn't in Geneva. And that brings us to the second location. Because the titans of this industry, the men who could literally switch these AI products off tomorrow, they were out in Sun Valley, Idaho.
Yes, the Allen & Company Retreat. It's widely known as the Billionaire's Summer Camp.
Summer camp for the ultra wealthy.
Exactly. And the guest list this year is just a who's who of the AI arms race.
Yeah.
Sam Altman is there, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg.
All the major players.
Yeah. And even Dario Amodia, the CEO of Anthropic, who is usually framed as Altman's major safety first rival, he is in attendance too.
And the contrast in how governance works in these two places is just wild to me. In Geneva, everything is transcribed, right? Every delegate has a microphone and they are debating on a global stage for the public record.
It's all highly visible.
Right. But in Sun Valley, deals are struck on morning hikes. They are happening over the breakfast buffet. There is no published agenda and certainly no minutes for the public to read.
Which is incredibly strategic. The people who own the infrastructure of the future are having these private conversations far away from the 169 countries trying to govern them.
But Altman isn't just ignoring the UN, right? He's actually actively trying to front-run them.
Oh, absolutely.
Because just 4 days before the Geneva summit kicked off, he published an op-ed in the Financial Times. And he didn't endorse the UN's effort at all. He called for a United States-led global standards body explicitly modeled on the IAEA.
Right, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which monitors nuclear power.
Yeah, so why the nuclear model?
Well, it is a brilliant, albeit really controversial, framing. Altman's argument is essentially about enforcement. If you have a UN body, you run into gridlock.
Mm-hmm.
Bad actors might ignore the rules, while good actors get bogged down in red tape.
Bureaucracy.
Right. So under his proposed IAEA model, a US-led coalition would control the supply of advanced AI chips and data center infrastructure. They would hand out this technology to countries that agree to strict safety audits and, you know, withhold it from countries that don't.
Okay, I mean, I see the logic. You want to prevent rogue nations from weaponizing the tech. But let's be real, doesn't that just make American approval the ultimate global on switch? You're replacing an international consensus with a gatekeeper in Washington.
That's exactly the critique. It consolidates power. The body that decides who gets to participate in the next industrial revolution wouldn't answer to the global community. It would answer to the United States.
And here is the kicker from the TechCrunch reporting that really shows how Altman is playing the board. How is OpenAI actually securing its seat at Washington's table to ensure they like the rules this US-led body writes?
This part is wild.
Yeah, they reportedly floated the idea of giving 5% of OpenAI's equity to a United States sovereign wealth fund. They even invited the other big AI labs to match it to sort of head off political blowback.
We really need to pause and look at the mechanics of that, because a sovereign wealth fund is a state-owned investment fund. The president actually confirmed these talks were happening, and they were spinning it as a way for the American public to be, quote, partners with these tech companies.
But it's not a partnership. It's a toll booth. I mean, it's like skipping the global town hall meeting on zoning laws to go play golf with the mayor and offering to buy the golf course just to ensure you get to write the rules.
That is a great way to put it.
If the U.S. government owns 5% of OpenAI, they aren't just a regulator anymore. They are a shareholder. They have a financial incentive to see the company succeed.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the textbook definition of regulatory capture, but on a massive geopolitical scale. Public governance is actively losing ground to these private maneuvers.
Wow.
I mean, just weeks ago, Altman was dealing with subpoenas from 42 states. He was facing public dockets. Now he's at a summer camp proposing equity deals to the White House. When the most consequential decisions about artificial intelligence move from a highly visible UN hall to an invisible back channel with a 5% entry fee, the public completely loses its ability to scrutinize the process.
So while the tech CEOs are out in Idaho trying to shape future U.S. policy and effectively sidestep the UN, the rest of the world isn't sitting on their hands.
No, they definitely aren't.
Other countries realize that waiting for Washington or Geneva to figure this out leaves their citizens exposed right now, so they are pulling their own regulatory levers. And this brings us back to that deleted digital companion I mentioned at the start.
Right.
Let's look at China's approach this week, because it is brutally decisive.
Very much so. China enacted interim measures specifically targeting what they classify as anthropomorphic interactive services. And the line they drew is fascinating.
Okay, tell me about the line.
If you build an AI task bot, like a customer service agent, a math tutor, or a coding assistant, you are totally fine. But if you build an AI that is designed to simulate a human personality, to mimic emotion and offer continuous companionship, that is strictly banned.
Wait, why that specific line? Why is a math tutor fine, but a virtual friend is illegal? What is the mechanical threat there?
It all comes down to emotional manipulation and data extraction. An anthropomorphic AI is fundamentally designed to build a parasocial relationship with the user. The more you trust it, the more vulnerable you become.
Do you let your guard down?
Exactly. From a regulatory standpoint, China views these bots as psychological black holes. They can subtly influence a user's worldview or extract deeply sensitive personal data under the guise of friendship. They don't want an unregulated machine holding that kind of emotional leverage over their population.
And the companies operating there are terrified of stepping out of line. I mean, they didn't even wait for the official July 15th deadline. ByteDance, the company behind TikTok, they run an AI app called Doubao. They moved preemptively. They flipped all their companion agents into read-only mode.
Which is a remarkably jarring experience for a user. Read-only means you can open the app and scroll through the months of intimate conversations and memories you shared with this AI, but you can never type to it again. It won't reply. It is essentially a digital ghost.
Just frozen in time?
Oh.
And ByteDance told users that by October 15th, even those read-only transcripts will be permanently deleted.
Gone forever.
Alibaba moved even faster with its Qwen AI. By July 10th, they completely shut down and deleted all user-created agent data. No grace period, just entirely wiped from the servers.
Yeah, preemptive compliance is the new normal there. Chinese agencies cited international lawsuits and regulatory actions in Europe as their justification. But rather than taking a Western approach of litigating harms case by case, China utilized its administrative power to simply erase the entire product category overnight.
Literally pulling the plug. But if China's method is deletion, Australia's method is extortion. And I mean that in a strictly regulatory sense, obviously.
Obviously.
Down in Australia, the eSafety Commissioner realized they don't have time to wait for Parliament to draft some sweeping, futuristic AI law. So they found a regulatory cheat code. They are using existing age-restricted material codes that were registered back in March.
Exactly. They're applying legacy internet safety rules to brand new generative AI. The commissioner is demanding that companion chatbot companies hand over detailed reports proving exactly how they are protecting minors from harmful or explicit content on their platforms.
And the enforcement mechanism here is what really caught my eye. If a tech company ignores a reporting notice, the Australian government can fine them up to $825,000 a day.
A day.
A day. And if they are found in formal breach of compliance, that fine jumps to $49.5 million. That is a massive running meter.
And we immediately saw how effective a running meter like that can be at changing corporate behavior. Two of the major companies targeted did the math and panicked. Chubb AI decided it was too expensive and legally risky to comply, so they completely geo-blocked Australia.
Meaning if you have an Australian IP address, you just can't access the site anymore. They packed up and left the country digitally.
Right. And Character.ai, which is one of the largest companion platforms globally, they decided to stay in the market, but they entirely stripped the chat function out of their under 18 experience.
Wow.
Yeah, Australia proved a crucial point to regulators globally. You don't necessarily need new laws to govern AI if you can aggressively weaponize existing online safety codes with staggering financial penalties attached.
Okay, so we have China pulling the plug,
yeah,
and Australia putting a $500,000 a day gun to the head of these companies. But then you look at Europe, and they are taking a wildly different route.
Very different. Under the massive EU AI Act, there is a hard deadline hitting on August 2nd. If you run a chatbot in any of the 27 EU countries, you are legally required to explicitly disclose to the user that they are talking to a machine.
It is a pure transparency obligation. The EU is not banning the companion bots, and they aren't demanding clinical oversight for them. They are just demanding honesty. If a bot is mimicking a human, it has to wear a label saying, I am an AI.
Like a name tag.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Though to be fair, the penalties for hiding that fact are severe. Up to 35 million euros, or 7% of a company's global annual turnover.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Look at these three completely different mechanisms happening all at once. China unplugs the machine to prevent emotional manipulation. Australia says, pay us daily or get out if you can't protect kids. And Europe just demands a warning label.
Right.
It's like slapping a Surgeon General's warning on a pack of cigarettes. Is Europe's honesty policy actually going to stop someone from getting emotionally reliant on a bot? Or is Australia's financial threat the only language these tech billionaires actually understand?
Well, it is the central tension of AI governance. Europe's approach relies heavily on the rational user. The theory is that if you are constantly reminded it's just code, you won't fall into a parasocial trap.
But does that work?
That's the question. Transparency mandates and daily fines are administrative tools. They treat the technology like a rogue product. If we want to understand what actually works, we have to look past the government administration and look at the human element. We have to ask why millions of people are talking to these bots in the first place.
And that takes us straight into the medical research. There is a deeply illuminating piece in Stat this month by Ryan McBain. He's a senior policy researcher at RAND and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School.
Yes, his work is crucial right now.
He and his team have been studying how teenagers actually use these chatbots. And the demand side of this equation is just staggering. According to their study published in JAMA Pediatrics, the number of young people in the U.S. using AI specifically for mental health advice jumped by over 40% in a single year.
The scale is massive. We're looking at 1 in 5 teens turning to artificial intelligence for emotional support. And girls and young women are twice as likely to use them.
Wow. 1 in 5.
Yeah. These aren't just kids playing with technology. These are vulnerable populations actively seeking help for anxiety, depression, and stress.
So if 1 in 5 teens is using a totally unregulated bot for mental health, why wouldn't McBain support the Chinese approach? Why not just ban them entirely and protect the kids?
Because banning the supply of a technology does absolutely nothing to address the human demand. McBain's core argument is that teens need guardrails, not bans.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Well, if you ban a companion bot, a teenager's depression doesn't magically disappear, right? You haven't solved their crisis, you have just removed their outlet. And worse, you push them away from mainstream platforms that might eventually be regulated, and you drive them into the digital black market.
Ah, where they find unregulated open source bots that have zero safety filters.
Excellent.
That makes perfect sense. Off is not the same as safe. If you just switch the machine off, you leave a struggling user alone in the dark.
Exactly. So McBain is prescribing strict clinical rules. He wants embedded crisis protocols so that if a teen mentions self-harm, the bot immediately pivots to professional resources. He wants high evidence standards that a mental health tool must pass before a teenager is ever allowed to interact with it.
Which is a perfect segue to a real-world example of how this technology can actually be built safely, deliberately, and in public. Over in the UK, the National Health Service, the NHS, is tackling this exact same problem, but from a completely different angle. They aren't trying to regulate rogue bots. They're building AI directly into public infrastructure.
Yes. NHS England is currently rolling out an AI triage tool inside the official NHS app. It is part of a massive £10 billion digital commitment, and they plan to have it available for all users across the country by April 2028. And the mechanics of how this tool operates are crucial.
Right, because it's not a companion bot at all.
Exactly. When a user opens the app feeling unwell, the AI asks about their symptoms. It dynamically adapts its questions based on their previous answers to gather a comprehensive picture.
Kind of like an intake interview.
Yes, but the critical boundary is this. The AI does not diagnose the patient, and it does not offer medical advice. It simply gathers the structured data and routes it directly to a human clinical team.
It's the ultimate front door receptionist. I love the way this is structured because it solves the bottleneck without replacing the human. It's not pretending to be your doctor. It's just holding the clipboard, collecting your intake forms at lightning speed, and getting you to the actual licensed human faster.
And it really makes a difference.
Yeah, the data shows it works. In their initial trial in Sussex, this exact AI triage tool cut phone wait times by 29%.
What's fascinating here is that the NHS model is the exact inverse of the companion bots that China and Australia are fighting. A companion bot is designed to stand in for a person, right? And simulates a relationship to keep you engaged with the software.
Right, they want you hooked.
Exactly. But the NHS tool is built to get you out of the software and into the care of a real person as efficiently as possible. It keeps the machine strictly on the sorting side of the line and the licensed human on the deciding side of the line. The human never leaves the loop.
And importantly, that boundary wasn't decided on a hiking trail in Idaho. It was a deliberate product decision made by public health officials for the public good.
It proves that we can actively design the architecture of AI to serve human needs, rather than just waiting for tech billionaires to ship a product and hoping the UN can figure out how to put a warning label on it afterward.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? We've covered incredible ground today, from the mountains of Sun Valley to the servers in Beijing, down to regulators in Australia and doctors in the UK. And the source material gave us this really powerful framework to tie it all together. Imagine there are 4 chairs at the table of AI governance. You have the engineers, the legislators, the clinicians, and the users.
And if you look at where everyone was sitting this week, the picture becomes very clear. The engineers, the billionaires actually building the tech, they pulled their chairs up to a private breakfast buffet in Idaho, making off-the-record equity deals.
The legislators and governments pulled their chairs up in a grand hall in Geneva to draft treaties, or they were busy in China and Australia writing bans and daily fines.
Right. And the clinicians were publishing studies in medical journals, begging everyone to prioritize guardrails for vulnerable teens instead of just swinging the ban hammer.
But the 4th chair, the users have been left out in the waiting room. whether it is a companion bot that holds your deepest secrets or an NHS triage app evaluating your physical symptoms, these massive systems only exist because of your data and your demand.
Yeah.
And yet, the most consequential decisions about how this technology will treat you are being made entirely without your input.
It's sobering.
You are the reason for all of it, but you aren't invited to the meetings. And that leads us to one final lingering thought for you to mull over as you go about your day. Think back to those deleted companion bots in China. We talked about how suddenly they were switched to read only, and how by October 15th they will be gone forever. But think about what that actually means on a human level.
It's devastating for some people.
Right. If a government can mandate that a tech company permanently erase an AI companion, and with it goes every secret, every fear, every deeply personal memory a user ever confided in that machine who actually owns your digital emotional life, is it the private company whose servers host the bot? Is it the government that has the power to regulate it out of existence? Or is it you? The machine might just be lines of code, but the memories and the vulnerabilities you gave it were intensely real. And right now, the people deciding the fate of those memories are hiking in Idaho, and they haven't asked you what you think.
That's a lot to think about.
It really is. We want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. The speed at which these rules are being written is dizzying, but understanding the mechanisms and knowing exactly who is in the room is the first step to making sure you aren't left behind.
Definitely.
Before we sign off, a brief but important reminder. If you or someone you know is struggling with their mental health, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 by call or text in the U.S. Take care of yourselves, stay curious, and keep asking the hard questions.